what we conceived. Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Oh, yeah. We started to burn too many things we found. That's the magnificent Dar Williams singing with David Burns and Pete Seeger, the Solartopia song. We're back for another week in Solartopia. Getting mighty depressing here in the United States of America. The Congress, the Trump Congress, the 51-49 or whatever it is, fascist majority in the Republican Party here is voting to cut $1.5 trillion from the tax bill for the super, super, duper rich, and to take that out of Medicare and Medicaid. So it is a direct transfer of wealth from the general population and the health care that we all need and deserve, and handing it to the Trump people, the billionaires and trillionaires who have more money than anybody should, and the rest of us can go jump in a lake, drop dead, whatever. It's an extremely depressing moment in American history. It is a blatant, stomach-turning, gut-wrenching theft of public resources, and all of us will suffer, or 99% of us are going to suffer for this. Very difficult. I have to say, I have a wonderful guest with me, Dane Waters. Dane, are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
Dane, how are you? Well, I've actually been better. Usually I'm able to distance myself from these political issues, having been a political animal for almost all of my 71 years. But I think what got to me, Dane, and all my listeners this week is I actually went to Las Vegas, which is my idea of hell. I think Las Vegas is, you know, what's depressing to me about Las Vegas is that here we have a situation where our species has virtually unlimited money. this is what they do with it. And I was at the Democratic National Committee meeting at Bally's, and to get to this committee meeting, you had to walk through this hellish room full of slot machines and gambling tables, and they allow smoking in this place in Bally's, and it was just, you know, like running the gauntlet of the world's worst environment, as far as I'm concerned. And then I was at the Democratic National Committee, and I have to say that I have never seen a more concentrated, rarely have seen a more concentrated collage of human mediocrity. I mean, the Democratic Party was host to one of the great uprisings a mere year ago, of grassroots, progressive, hopeful, loving, you know, movement sentiment in the Sandinista, the Bernie movement, 30 million many millennials, people, you know, demanding social change, and then to war, and then to injustice, then to racism, the beginning of a real community, and in swoop the Hillary, the Clintonistas, the second rate corporate Democrats, and they basically won the day, and then Hillary proceeded to blow the election completely winnable easily, and she won, actually didn't fight for it, and we wind up with Donald Trump in the White House. You know, to me, if an alien species arrived on Earth to check things out and they saw Donald Trump, I think they would probably just wipe out the entire human race to prevent infection of the rest of the universe. And this is what we have in the White House, and it just gets more and more difficult. It's a very, very dark time in our society, and I'm writing a history of the United States, and I had a draft up through 1992, and I've been holding off to see, you know, what the outcome would be, and the outcome is not pretty, and I started writing it, and Dane, we have our work cut out for us. I just watched your wonderful video, I Love You, Dane Waters, and you are a very, very interesting guy, and I'm very happy to introduce you to my listeners. We have a full hour, which I have no doubt that you will beautifully fill. You're a brilliant and entertaining and thoughtful guy. So we have a lot to talk about in terms of your work with elephants, and I am planning to come to your benefit in Santa Barbara next week. But I do want to start with I usually give my guests a very brief introduction, and I let them introduce themselves, because I want to hear from you what you think is important about yourself. And I want to talk about what you did at the Republican convention and your views on the current administration and where we're headed in this country. And then, if you don't mind, we'll talk about elephants as well. So, Dane, where are you? And I think you're in Florida, yeah? And what is it that you do primarily in life to have gotten you to this point in our history?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I've heard a lot about your show, and I'm excited to be here today. And I'm actually just arrived in Charleston, South Carolina. I do live in Fernandina Beach, down near Jacksonville, Florida, after living 25 years in wonderful Washington, D.C. But I'm here. I'm playing in a golf tournament here tomorrow for a charity for dealing with underage mothers, and so that's why I'm here in Charleston, South Carolina for that tomorrow. But I, you know, my background and what I do on a day-to-day basis is interesting. I'm very fortunate to have the life that I have, but I've been working primarily over the last year and a half trying to help elephants, Asian and African elephants, because I, you know, my background is Latin Republican politics, and I think that saving elephants, real live elephants, is a much easier thing than doing anything with the Republican Party. So I've decided to focus my life on that. But in addition to that, I do a lot of work on trying to help people with the right to self-determination. I do a lot of international work, like, for example, helping Western Sahara try to gain their independence from Morocco and Algeria, and you know, things of that nature, because I'm a firm believer in that the people, you know, people's power, that they have the right to do as they wish, as long as it doesn't infringe upon other individuals. So that's kind of there's a lot of different things to talk about.
Let me ask you real quick and not let the moment go by. What do you think of what's happening in Catalonia in Spain?
Well, it's interesting. I think that, you know, listen, you know, the mechanism that they used, I'm a big believer in direct democracy, initiative and referendum. You know, I study that. I've written a lot of books on that. And I do believe that, you know, Catalonia, if they were to want to truly leave and be an independent part of Spain, that they should have the right to do that. The problem there is that the mechanism they used, the referendum that they used, was not, by international standards, a legitimate referendum, because it was not, it was conducted basically by individuals who just really wanted to leave. So I think that, but a majority of people have made it clear, for the most part, that they don't want to be part of Spain. And I think that the central government is overreaching by definitely trying to basically take their thumb and stamp out what's going on in Catalonia. And I think it's going to eventually backfire on the central government. And it's an issue that I think is going to continue to percolate because the Catalonians see that they have this opportunity. They finally have an opportunity for them to gain their independence if they were so, you know, if that's what they want. And so I think that that they will continue pushing that. And I'm just concerned about the increased pushback by the central government. So,
well, what do you think about us here in California? We did the United States. I'm ready. I don't know about, I don't know how a vote would go, but I'd like to see a country that includes California, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Hawaii, and Puerto Rico. what do you think of that one?
Well, you're taking all the good states is what you're doing.
Yeah,
so,
I know. You'll notice I skipped over Nevada.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona. But I mean, there's been, for years, and working with the initiative process, people have reached out to me about a wide variety of initiatives they want to do. One of the most interesting ones, as a side note, was that a group out of Arizona wanted to do an initiative to designate Arizona as the official landing area for UFOs if they were to decide to come to America. But it's quite interesting. But in California, over the years, I've received numerous questions about, hey, how does California separate from the rest of the union? How, or can we break it into three distinct states and all that kind of stuff? So, I'm from Alabama. I'm an Alabama boy. I'm an East Coast kind of guy. In California, when I go out there, I love it, but it's a different universe. So, but I love it. I think it's an amazing state.
Yeah. Well, I'm ready to go. That's one of the reasons I moved here from Ohio. I am hoping, and we're close in California to getting universal health care. It was stopped by the Democrats. Of course, it's pretty much a one party state now, which is not good, even if it is the Democrats. And I think that independence for this state would be a great thing. And we'll see what happens. I mean, a few more months of Trump, I think everybody's going to be pretty much ready to rock and roll here, but we'll see what happens. Certainly Hawaii, which was a country. I mean, Hawaii, of all the parts of the United States, the inclusion of Hawaii is in many ways the most egregious. They had a constitutional monarchy. They had a queen, Liliuokalani, had absolutely no desire to be part of the United States. And there was an uprising of sugar growers in 1893, and wound up being taken over by the United States in 1898. There are plenty of countries, plenty of people in Hawaii who really want to go back and to being independent. And then the question of Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, as I'm sure you know, Dane, had nothing to do with the United States. It was a Spanish colony. There was an uprising in Cuba. The United States sent the battleship Maine to Havana Harbor. It was blown up. We accused the Spaniards of blowing up, but we're now 100% certain that the Maine was not blown up by the Spaniards. We went to war, and we basically, allegedly, to help the Cubans get free of Spain. We did that. Then somehow we didn't leave, and Cuba became an American colony, and along the way, so did Puerto Rico. And Puerto Rico has been a colony ever since of the United States. And now, how can we even begin to justify the treatment to which the Puerto Ricans have been subjected after Maria? I mean, it's just a travesty. And here we go. I mean, there are three roads in Puerto Rico that people have talked about: statehood, current Commonwealth status, or independence. And what do you think, since you deal with these issues?
Well, first of all, I'm going to say something about Hawaii. Next year, Hawaii is one of 10 states in the country that have automatic votes on whether to have a constitutional convention at the state level. I think there's a lot of interest in Hawaii to pass it so they can deal with some of these issues that you talk about, or possibility of independence or establishing the initiative and referendum process. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in Hawaii over the next 2 years in that regard. But as far as Puerto Rico, listen, I've spent a lot of time in Puerto Rico. I own property out in the western part of the country, of the island, in Rincon. I've spent, almost more time there than I have in any other place in the world, and it's an amazing place. And I think that, to me, I find it, it's such a reprehensible, unforgivable, what the federal government is doing as far as their support for Puerto Rico, or lack thereof, I should say, because, you know, most Americans don't even think of Puerto Rico as part of the United States. I have friends who go there on cruises and think, oh, I need a passport because, you know, it's part of, you know, it's a different country. And, I mean, it's a totally different culture. And you know, and listen, I Pedro Rosello years ago, the former governor, was on my advisory board for the Initiative and Referendum Institute. And because he was a strong believer in independence in the country. But the federal government, you know, never gave them the opportunity. And one of the problems they have, as you know, is just this tremendous amount of debt. I mean, and I think that, you know, not counting all the debt that's happening now because of the hurricane. So the challenge is, I, to me personally, especially given what's going on now, I don't think that there's any doubt that Puerto Rico would vote to basically become totally a completely independent country. You know, because they're not seeing getting the support from the mainland that they feel they deserve and rightfully that they do deserve.
They don't appreciate all those paper towels that President Trump.
You know, I could talk about it. Listen, I could talk about Trump for hours upon hours upon hours, but it's just that I mean, the guy lacks all type of empathy, and if you could be in a crowd like that or anywhere on the island, and your only impulse to help people is to throw them paper towels. I mean, I'd love to see the guy. I don't think he would. I don't think he would even know how to work in a soup kitchen. I don't think he would know how to serve food. I don't think the guy has even the base knowledge or understanding how to support another human being. And I think that it was just another one of those perfect examples of the disgusting behavior of Donald Trump. But not to get too far off Puerto Rico, but let me tell you, I've worked for, you know, five presidents. I've been around politicians around the entire world, some that I just personally just didn't like for many reasons, but I've never had such a vitriol response or visceral response to an individual like Donald Trump. And anyway, so we can come back to Donald Trump. But as far as Puerto Rico, I really do believe that, you know, one thing I'm hopeful for is that Congress will, regardless of statehood, that Congress will see what's going on there and finally allow the country to either, to file for bankruptcy or do whatever they have to do just to get out from underneath this debt that will just not allow for Puerto Rico to have a future, as long as they have it. So.
It's just sickening. I mean, this whole concept that Puerto Rico should have a unified debt, and then this insane Jones Act, where they're required to have everything transshipped on American boats. I mean, you know, this is a classic abuse. I mean, it's a rape, basically, of an island that, through no fault of its own, became a colony of the United States in 1898, has been just maltreated ever since. It's just unreal to me. Now, let me put this for you, because I've done a lot of talking about. We're talking a lot about a group of people who are into the environment of trying to see if Puerto Rico can go 100% solar, so that there are no more electric grid, and that central grid. Except to carry juice from the couple. There's a couple of wind farms there, and I guess a couple of central solar arrays. But the point is that Puerto Rico would be, its whole electrical system would be built around microgrids that would be powered by solar panels on a decentralized basis. And, you know, that's what we're hoping will happen there. Have you seen? And I just read actually yesterday that or 2 days ago that Elon Musk made one hospital there completely energy self-sufficient, that they put in solar panels and batteries. And so now this hospital is off-grid, and that's the way we want the whole island to go. Do you think there's any chance of that happening?
Well, I think so. I think one of the concerns, though, is just like what happens in America just about every day is that, you know, a heinous act will happen, and then, you know, a week to 2 weeks later, there's very little discussion about it. I mean, look what, you know, you're just in Vegas. I mean, look what happened in Vegas, and, you know, hardly anybody ever talks about it anymore. And I think that Puerto Rico has the opportunity, to really come out of this stronger. And I think that, you know, assuming that the interest continues there. I mean, I think Elon Musk and what he's trying to do, I've even heard stories from other people who know him that he really wants to use this as an opportunity to basically try to make the island completely redo the infrastructure of the electrical grid there. And as you just talked about, I mean, the electrical grid there is, you know, I've done work in Guyana. I've done work in, and you know, and Lozada. I've done work all over the world, and I've seen better power grids than they have in Puerto Rico, which is sad considering, you know, that in theory the U.S. government should be helping them. So I think that, you know, I think you should look at Puerto Rico basically that you're starting from scratch as far as I'm concerned, as far as the infrastructure. And to, you know, to go off on a little wild tangent, I mean, in the western part of the country where my piece of property is, you know, we were trying to, you know, get a sewer line, you know, tie into the existing sewer line out there, just tap into it like most people do. But the local, you know, but unfortunately the pipes were so frail that you couldn't tap into it because it had there was a chance that it could actually disintegrate that portion of the sewer line and basically mean that it has to be completely replaced and there's just not any money to do that. So the entire infrastructure of Puerto Rico is in shambles and need to be redone. But I think that, you know, I think that, you know, Puerto Rico now represents a tremendous opportunity. You know, I would love to see what Elon Musk is doing. I know several other solar energy companies are doing work like in Africa and Southeast Asia and others that I've heard from that are interested in going into Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico actually can become, you know, literally the shining example of how solar operates. And it's just surprising that it hasn't been, you know, done more on the island. And I think, once again, it goes back to monopolies. You got big business. You got people who just want to protect their industries and that they'll do anything in power. You know, the people who control the grid and who want to make sure that they control their little fiefdom and want to allow what's in the best interest of the island. And you're seeing that a lot throughout the entire Caribbean, not just in Puerto Rico. So,
yeah, well, you know, Puerto Rico gets its power. 2% came from wind and solar. There is a wind farm on the southern shore of Puerto Rico that was unharmed by Maria. And there was a guy, I think he was the only guy on the island, he had a greenhouse business and it was totally solarized. He invested about $300,000 a few years ago. He lost about a quarter of his panels in the storm, but he's got three quarters and he was back in business the next day. And, you know, that's the obvious way for Puerto Rico to go. Apparently, Elon Musk had already been a principal in solarizing American Samoa, which I believe is a virtually 100% solar. And then there are quite a few communities in southern Germany now that are totally solar. And there are actually five cities in the United States that are 100% renewable, including Burlington, Vermont. But the idea, I mean, clearly Puerto Rico is such a perfect candidate to go 100% renewable. And then we read in the last day or two that the power authority in Puerto Rico gave a $300 million contract to a company called Whitefish Energy from somewhere in, I don't know, Idaho or Montana, which has two people in it and no experience doing this whatsoever, but the guy is a friend of the Secretary of Interior. I'm sure you've read that.
Yeah, it's out of Montana. And let me go back to solar for a second, because you know where I live in Jacksonville, just north of where I live, and Georgia, is one of the largest nuclear submarine fleets in the U.S. Navy. But they just built, or they're still building, actually, the largest solar farm in the United States there. And actually, the city of Jacksonville, where I live, is going to be buying that excess capacity, and we as taxpayers are paying for it, for that large solar farm there, for the U.S. Navy. And so the thought is that why don't they, you know, invest that kind of money into Puerto Rico, for example, because the economic benefit to the island and to the region, you know, it would be, you know, so substantial that it would justify the cost versus building, like, you know, the solar farm in Jacksonville that basically just benefits the U.S. Navy. But But I the $300 million contract. I mean, I think I just saw that the GAO or somebody was going to investigate because Secretary Zimke, I think is his name, from Montana.
Zink.
Yeah, but one thing that the Puerto Ricans said, reading the stories, they said that, hey, one of the reasons that they accepted the offer because they didn't ask for any like $25 million bond payment or something.
Yeah, right.
So it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
The company is two guys. I mean, that's the whole company. These two guys, and they claim that they were they had experience working in the mountains. It's $300 million. You can solarize that island, for God's sake.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, if you put a solar panel, they're around $1,000, actually less. But for $300 million, you can get 300,000 solar panels. I mean, come on, it's ridiculous. So anyway, I don't have to tell you all that. One thing about Puerto Rico that we fear is that what they really want to do, what Trump and his minions really want to do, is what about 5 million people, 5 million people in Puerto Rico? I think it's about 3.5 million. It's basically they want to move people out. And a lot of people have left and gone to Florida and elsewhere, and then just buy up the place for nothing and turn it into what Cuba was before the revolution, which is, a whorehouse. I just get to build casinos and resorts and Mar-a-Lagos and bring in the hookers and kick everybody else out. I mean, that's the Trump vision of the future of Puerto Rico. So. But there are a lot of people
they expect. I mean, it's like Detroit. Detroit lost over 1.5 million people as the industry, car industry, went kaput. And then they had an infrastructure and that was for like 5 million people, and the tax base could no longer support it. I mean, the estimates I've seen is that they're expecting 1 million people to leave Puerto Rico. When you think about it, you take away that tax base and you take away that consumer base. I mean, for an island, you say, for 3.5 million people. The problem is the fiscal impact of that many people leaving is going to be huge on the island, because even if they do get this $78 billion or $100 billion, whatever the debt load is, I can't remember, even if they do get it relief from that, then the question becomes, how do they start paying for some of this stuff? Because if 1 million people are gone and they're not paying taxes, or contributing or running businesses or being entrepreneurs or whatever it may be, it's even going to be a bleaker future for Puerto Rico. So,
yeah, God, well, it's a tragedy. There's no doubt about it, and made even more tragic by the insanity of what we have going on in the White House. So, I do want to talk with you about elephants, but before we jump in there, I do want to give you a shot to talk about Donald Trump. And I know that you were at the Republican convention in Cleveland. You had a group that wanted to why don't I let you paraphrase it, because people should watch your film, by the way. It's quite beautiful. And explain to us what you were doing at the Republican convention and what you had helped to accomplish and what you feel actually happened.
Well, I appreciate that. As far as a little background, I mean, I've always been a believer that I'm not a big fan of, it's a longer debate about the primary system in this country and how the primary system operates. And I think that, and also another point, I believe that as a country of 325 million people, I think that it's ridiculous to think that two political parties can represent all of us. And I believe we need to have more parties that truly represents the people. And the only way to do that is to break up the control of the duopoly, that control the state legislatures, that set all the rules as far as ballot access, as far as the way primaries go and all that kind of stuff. So I'm a big believer and have been a big believer that we need to figure out how to address, get true redistricting reform and all that kind of stuff. And so, and just seeing Donald Trump, and just from the, and I met him, for full disclosure, I met him years ago when I worked for John McCain, and I traveled a little bit with Donald Trump, and back then I find him just to be a disgusting, reprehensible individual. But and as I said, I just, it's funny, I just really do, and my my girlfriend told me that I need to seek therapy because whenever I talk about Donald Trump, I get just like this visceral reaction. But it's
is therapy. Where if you've met Donald Trump, the only way to get over it is to talk about him.
That's right. You know, but you know, but she says, you know, I can only listen so much to this stuff, Dave. But so at the convention, I was a firm believer, you know, this whole thing about binding delegates so that they had to vote for Donald Trump. I mean, I don't want to get into all the minutia about it, but fundamentally that was just a fallacy. It was just a lie that the delegates had to vote for Donald Trump. So I started this group, along with a couple of others, called Delegates Unbound. And what we were doing is that we were trying to ensure that the delegates at the RNC convention had the opportunity to honestly vote for anybody else other than Donald Trump to be the nominee. They had the freedom and the right to exercise their responsibility to represent the party and to choose a nominee that represents not only just the values of the party, which is suspect in many ways to begin with, but to be the check and balance on the primary system where, you know, listen, the only reason Donald Trump, other than the Russian involvement, but the only reason that Donald Trump got the nomination is because there were 15 or 16 people in it. And with that, you know, we need to press in certain states 30%, 28%, 42%, whatever it is. You know, and then you have these committed delegates. It's like winner take all. And then they go to the convention and they think, hey, we have to vote for Donald Trump. It's an absurdity. So this group we started in hopes of trying to find anybody who would seek the nomination other than Donald Trump. So we did everything in our power to ensure that the delegates were free to vote, you know, for somebody other than Donald Trump. But what was extremely disappointing among many things is that no one stood up. I mean, there wasn't a single Republican of any kind that stood up and said, hey, let me take on this madman. And even to this day, as you know, you're seeing that there's just no moral, there's just, you know, not that I'm the most moral human being on the planet. I'll make that very clear. You know, and I truly have more skeletons in my closet than, you know, probably a graveyard. But you know, he's president of the United States. And I do think that it's important that somebody who has a bully pulpit, you know, is not insane and is just is not morally corrupt. And so the fact that no single Republican ever stood up to take him on at the convention was a problem. So, but what happened was, is that one thing I've discovered, and after being involved in political campaigns all over, is that anybody who speaks out against Donald Trump, and you see that his character brings this out, is that the nastiness of these people, there's no more political discourse in this country. You can't say, hey, I disagree with that policy, I disagree with that policy. What we did in Cleveland, I received so many, you know, hateful emails. It's not just necessarily hateful emails. I had to contact the FBI because people were threatening to kill me. They were threatening to kill my son. They reached out to my son at his university. They drove by his house. You know, all this stuff. And I think it just represents the environment and the, you know, what Donald Trump has brought to this country, and that's what we try to stop. You know, because you know we, a lot of people had concerns that this toxic environment would follow him and you know, be toxic to the rest of the country throughout his administration. So we did everything in our power to try to stop him, and then we tried to work for the Electoral College to do their due diligence and push back. The Electoral College is not a rubber stamp, was never meant to be a rubber stamp. So to me, everyone throughout the process, whether it's the delegates or whether it's the Electoral College, I mean, you know, they all abdicated their responsibility to be a check and balance on the electoral process, and which is just very disappointing to me. So I every single day, just like the rest of us know, every single day when Donald Trump, you know, I just brace myself every single day. It just makes me literally physically nauseous, physically nauseous just to hear him when he opens his mouth. So.
I can't look at him. You know, just it makes me sick also. So, well, listen, let's move on to a happier topic. Let's talk about actual elephants. I deeply admire the work you're doing with elephants. And why don't you explain it, please? And let's see where we go with this.
excuse me, you're getting me all choked up here. And thanks for my therapy about Donald Trump. I appreciate that.
we all need it. I mean, I have to say that I have never met a human being as loathsome and despicable. And it never really occurred to me or to, I think, the majority of human beings that any of our fellow humans could be so low. And, you know, then you think about this guy, Steve Bannon, who apparently has a complete psychopathology here that he wants to impose on the rest of the world. He seems to be even worse than Trump in many ways because he seems to have a brain. And, you know, this is what we're up against now. And we really need to figure out, as never before, how we're going to deal with this. I mean, I remember Richard Nixon. Nixon, I thought, was about as low as it went. I never thought that about George W. Bush. I did think about Dick Cheney and Karl Rove, but you know, these people are seriously twisted. They are. If there is a definition of a person who's evil, they are. And it is now incumbent on us to figure out how to take power back from them. And I have to say that having been with the Democrats in Las Vegas the last weekend, I'm not encouraged. I don't see. I think the Sandinistas, the Bernie people, I think Bernie himself and the social movement that that put him into prominence, there is hope there. That we do have a good, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed core in this country, about 30 million people who are active and who prepared to, who believe in democracy and believe in the healing powers of the earth and the abilities of the human spirit to move ahead. But, you know, I wrote my friend that it makes you kind of believe in astrology. I mean, I'd like to find an astrologer to tell us, you know, what phases of Pluto and all the other planets we're under now and when it's going to end, because there's just so much confluence. I mean, look at what we saw in the last month. We had hurricanes, Harvey, Irma, Maria, the lunatic in Nevada, you know, the fires in North Carolina, Northern California, which to me were apocalyptic. I mean, I've been in Santa Rosa, California. What a gorgeous town. I rode my bike around, and then you see pictures of it, and it looks like Hiroshima after the bombing. Mm-hmm. And one thing I will say about Northern California and the catastrophe there, nobody wanted Trump to show up. Nobody is complaining that Trump has said nothing about the catastrophe in Northern California. Nobody wants him involved. You know, we want, there's a need for federal money and federal resources and things like that. But everybody I've talked to from Northern California, when I say Trump, you know, completely left you guys out to dry, everybody says, thank God, we don't want him anywhere near us. You know, we don't need paper towels thrown at us in Northern California. So that much is there. But, what a horrific month we've had. Now this tax assault on the tax structure combined with the assault on Medicare and Medicaid, it's a lot. You know, it's really a lot. I'm a born optimist. I've been a political activist all my life, and I got to say, it's a really dark time. So is there anything else? Any other, Sarah? Go ahead.
Well, that's why I think elephants is a good topic to you know, because I think that, I mean, it ties into my feelings about Trump as well, because I think that, you know, if we as a society, you know, can't come together to protect such a majestic, iconic species, keystone species, then I think that you know, that we are, abandoning our responsibility as custodians of this planet. I mean, you know, the Elephant Project, I'll give you kind of a quick overview of it. I mean, I've been involved in animal welfare issues. I mean, I'm one of those, I guess, you know, people always laughed about, you know, hey, I'm Republican politics, but I care so much about animals. I mean, I was the political director of the Humane Society of the United States for 5 years, did a lot of work of their international stuff as well. I think that animals are, you know, all animals. I mean, whether it's, it's the groundhog in Colorado, or whether it's, whether it's polar bears, or whether it's baby seals, or whether it's elephants, I think that animals we as human beings should do everything in our powers to help, limit our footprint on this planet. And these animals were here long before we were. But the Elephant Project, I mean, I've always, being in the nonprofit world, like a lot of, people have, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners have been as well. I mean, raising money is a constant issue, for nonprofits. And so I thought that, I'm also come from the school that a good idea sells itself, right? And, there's been over $1 billion invested in elephant welfare, elephant conservation efforts over the last decade. So, I came with this, working with some other individuals, we came with this idea called the Elephant Project. And we've, our mission statement, our mission is to ensure the long-term survival of elephants by developing humane and socially responsible economies through the creation of sustainable, free, and fair market funding solutions. And what that means is basically that we want to help individuals recognize that, honestly, to put it bluntly, a live elephant is worth more than a dead elephant to the people and to the countries, that they live in. And look around, countries like Myanmar, for example, where we're very active in. I mean, it's a country where elephants are not necessarily being poached for their ivory, but they're being skinned to make beads. They're being skinned for medicinal purposes. It's taken over the border into China. And, that has a lot to do with the fact that the locals and the villagers see that there's more money in that, killing the elephants for their skin, to make these cheap trinkets, than to protect them. And so our program is to go into a country like Myanmar and helping to establish a humane economy where everyone from the government down and the people up see that protecting these elephants have a greater fiscal impact on them and their livelihood. And so what we're going to do is that through a series of what we call free and fair market solutions, we're going to build communities. The revenue from these communities will go into elephant conservation efforts. But what will also happen is that, most of the villagers in Myanmar, for example, once again, it goes back to solar power. I went to several of these villages where, like villages of 1,200, they have one solar panel. Everyone has a car battery, and they take their turns charging that car battery, and that's the power they have for the village. But they have really no running water. They have no sewer. They have no access to education. They have no access to health care. And it's a country of 51 million. So our program, what we're going to do is provide perpetual funding that will not only take care of the elephants, but also provide running water for the inhabitants, sewer for the inhabitants, access to education, access to health care, so the quality of their lives, if they so choose to go down this path, the quality of their lives would be enhanced. And then they would see that for them and for their children and for their parents and for their sisters and their neighbors, that protecting these elephants, because of what we're doing with the Elephant Project, has greater value to their lives than allowing them to be killed, allowing them to be poached. So that's kind of the concept there. And it's designed to be replicated around the world. We're working in Malawi in Africa. We're working in Cambodia. But Myanmar, one thing that's interesting about Myanmar, what a lot of people don't recognize, is that Asian elephants are more endangered than African elephants. There are only roughly 50,000 Asian elephants left. And of that 50,000, roughly 16,000 of that 50 are in captivity, what we call. And that's they're either government owned because they're timber elephants. They're being used, for illegal logging purposes. And Myanmar specifically has the largest concentration of privately owned and government owned elephants. So of the 50,000, 45,000, honestly, Asian elephants left, 5,000 of those, over 10% of those, are either owned by the government or have been contracted to the government through private ownership of these elephants. And so what we're doing, and honestly, the government can no longer provide to care for these elephants and the mahouts. So we're working with them to bring a sustainable funding solution so that these elephants are no longer in captivity. They no longer have to log, and they are protected. And the mahouts that provide for them have long-term employment. And so we're our project in Myanmar is designed to save over 10% of the Asian elephant population. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. I know it's a huge project. Like in Myanmar, we'll be investing close to $400 million into the country. I think it's a transformational project that can bring sustainable long-term protection to elephants.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. Now, how long have you been doing this?
I for 2 years, it goes back to what we talked about earlier, my background. I mean, I've been involved in international politics. I've been an architect. I've been a real estate developer. I've cared about animals, specifically elephants. I've worked a lot in Southeast Asia and Africa. So 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, roughly, since I'm a very old, 52 years of age, I said, how can I use all of this experience, to do what I'm the most passionate about, and that is protecting elephants. And so this project allows me the opportunity to use all that diverse experience, to work with some amazing people on our advisory board and supporters around the world to do this. So roughly 2 years. And, we're currently in Myanmar. We're negotiating a memorandum of understanding with the government that will allow us to do our due diligence phase of trying to figure out the viability of some of the components of our effort. But we will be, we're raising money currently to put radio tracking collars on some of the elephants, because they're so remote in some of these jungles that they're hard to find and poachers can easily find them. So we want to track them so we can immediately send a security force out there to stop the poaching of them. So that's one of the things we're raising money for. We're also raising money to help provide better food and veterinarian care for these elephants, because these formerly captive elephants no longer receive the veterinarian care that they were receiving, and so it's critical that they get that veterinarian care. So we're doing a lot of stuff in the interim. This is a 20-30 year project in Myanmar, but to try to bring immediate care for these elephants. And while I'm talking about that, we're doing there's a fundraiser that's being held in Santa Barbara on November 9th at the Belmont El Encanto. I don't know if I said that correctly or not. Malcolm McDowell, Juliet Mills, several other wonderful individuals, Naomi Prinz, Nigel Chisholm, are all co-hosting this event that you're coming to, thankfully, to raise money to help with the immediate care and needs of these Burmese timber elephants. So.
Well, it's fantastic. So have you had noticeable success that you can point to so far?
Yeah, in Myanmar, for example, the government, because of our efforts there, the government has decided, because what was happening in Myanmar, the 3,000 government-owned elephants, they were actually in the process of honestly letting them loose in the wild, firing them basically. And I mean, you think about a captive elephant who's lived his whole life with people. You let that elephant loose in the wild, it's easier for poachers basically to come up and kill the elephant. So in reaching out to the government and the civilian government and talking to them, they've decided to delay the release of those elephants because of our efforts in the country. Which honestly, will tangibly, stop some of this poaching and killing that's going to take place of these elephants. So that's a tangible solution that we're working on. The other thing that we're working on is we're partnering with the Cambodia Wildlife Sanctuary in Cambodia, where it's a totally different issue in Cambodia because of the millions of landmines in the country. Wildlife has been decimated. If anybody's been in Cambodia, you go to a lot of parts of the country, especially around Angkor Wat and others and Siem Reap, you see very little wildlife. You don't hear many animals. And so there's this big push to repopulate the species as best as possible. So the Cambodia Wildlife Sanctuary is a million-acre sanctuary an hour north of Angkor Wat, where we're working through our relationships with Myanmar, government of Myanmar, is that we are negotiating taking 35 elephants and transporting to the Cambodian Wildlife Sanctuary to help repopulate the elephant, the elephant population in Cambodia. So the Cambodia Wildlife Sanctuary is an amazing facility. There's a guy in Los Angeles by the name of David Castleman who founded it. And that's the kind of stuff that really is going to do a lot of to help not only protect the current population, but we have to ensure. I mean, as a total side note, one of the things that we're working on is that, with climate change and if we save all the elephants that are out there, one of the issues is that with climate change, there may not be enough food and water to even provide for all these elephants. So one thing that has to be looked at is carrying capacity of the land where these elephants are, trying to address the impact of climate change on their environment. And we may have to do things like what just happened in Malawi, where they literally transported 500 elephants from the southern part of the country to the northern part of the country to kind of balance it out for the carrying capacity of the land. So there's so much going on. I mean, most people think about poaching of elephants. They think about just killing them for ivory. But, I mean, human-elephant conflicts, climate change impact. There's so many issues, not just with elephants, but other wildlife that needs to be looked at. And so the tangible is that, we've got Myanmar to stop the release of these elephants. We're very optimistic about bringing elephants to Cambodia to help start that repopulation of what's going on there. And Malawi, one thing we're doing in Malawi is through our efforts providing funding sources for another amazing organization called African Parks that's doing amazing work there. And so we want to partner with them to help bring funding so that they can, in perpetuity, provide the support and care and protection for these elephants. So.
Wow. How do people look you up and look up your organization? What are your contacts?
Well, to register for the event, theelephantproject.net, is our primary website. And if you go there, there's a link to events where you can register to go to the event in Santa Barbara on November 9th. We also have a part of our website called the Elephant Times, where we have podcasts and we have blogs and we have access to other educational material where you can learn about not just our effort, but about elephants as a whole. And then we also have this thing called the Elephant Shop, where we are sourcing products made in countries that are supporting elephant conservation efforts. We've sourced products from Myanmar. We're sourcing products from Vietnam. The other thing I want to say about our project is 100% of all the net profits go back into elephant conservation efforts. You have some groups out there, companies that give 10%, which is just great that anybody gives any money to elephant conservation efforts. But this is all 100% of everything we sell, every house we sell, every room we lease, everything that we do, 100% of the net profits go back into elephant conservation efforts in the host country. So everyone knows and sees the value of ensuring that an elephant is humanely protected.
Well, good for you. I think that's fantastic. That's really fantastic. And I hope that your efforts continue with great power. Do you have any connection at all with the federal government? Are there any federal programs or federal money that come to you?
I try to stay away from the federal government as much as possible, in many reasons. But yeah, I tell you, the problem is that, not to every road leads to Trump, but the current administration is so anti-animal, it's not even funny. You can look and find pictures of Eric Trump who have been out killing elephants, killing other endangered species and wildlife. When it comes to puppy mills and things of that nature, they've even taken down the negative reports about puppy millers. I mean, so this administration is extremely dismissive of animal welfare efforts. Some of the stringent controls about ivory that the Obama administration negotiated is being overturned through regulation. So it's not enforced, I should say. So this administration and the federal government has not been very helpful. I tell you, we've received support from the Swiss government, which has been amazing. But because most just about everyone else in the world, every other government in the world recognizes the importance of, you know, of protecting this amazing species, because I do believe it's a testament to our humanity. I mean, if we can't protect such an amazing species, then, you know, who are we as a world if we can't do that? So, but no, I mean, our support will come from individuals. You know, I encourage, you know, our donations are tax deductible. So I encourage your listeners to please, you know, every dollar helps. And every dollar that you give goes 100% into elephant conservation. As we say, a donation today saves an elephant tomorrow.
And where do people go again?
TheElephantProject.net. TheElephantProject.net. And when you go there, you can click on donations. You can sign up for the events. You can buy the products that we have there, and any of those will help us our efforts in protecting these animals.
How many actual elephants are there in North America? I assume they're all in zoos.
Well, there's roughly 400 captive elephants in North America. 99% of them, 90% of them are in zoos. But when we say zoos, it's not just normal zoos we talk about. There's also roadside zoos. Even though the Ringling Brothers no longer uses elephants in their performances, there's still a lot of circuses out there that do. There's an organization in Oregon that basically rents out their elephants to zoos and events. Circuses and events. So, yeah, there's 400 captive elephants. The Humane Society of the United States and PAWS, which is out there in Southern California, and other groups are doing amazing work in the country to limit that. I mean, one of our goals would be to help send some of these elephants back to their homeland, you know, back to Asia. But yeah, I mean, the environment there are good zoos out there, like the San Diego Zoo is a good zoo for elephants, and there's others. The Tennessee Elephant Sanctuary is really good. But, you know, my personal goal would love to see every elephant, no elephant in captivity, every elephant living the life that an elephant deserves to live. So,
wow, that's really, really amazing. Well, I certainly hope that you continue to prosper. It's been a real honor to have you on our show. And I will see you in Santa Barbara. What is the event again, real quick, before we run out of time here?
It's November 9th, 6 to 9:30 in Santa Barbara at the Belmont El Encanto, and it's to help save Burma's timber elephants, and I hope all of you will come.
Well, I will be there. I'm honored to have you on the show, and let's hope we can save that elephant and get rid of the one in the White House. So,
listen, thank you very much for having me today. I greatly appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you, and we'll be seeing you soon enough. This has been a fabulous show on Solartopia. Thank you to the crew and everyone else. Pete Seeger will come in a moment, and we'll see you next week in Solartopia.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.